morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Once upon a time in a previous millennium, there was a man who postured male supremacy and did not believe women had the right to abortion. This man, who was by no stretch of imagination singular in his opinion among other males then and now, compared a U.S. Supreme Court decision about abortion that transferred a woman's right to abortion to state authority to the infamous court decision of 1857 concerning a black slave named Dred Scott, who had sued for his freedom. The High Court's ruling to gut but preserve the skeleton of the 1972 abortion law, Roe versus Wade, was, the man said, analogous to Dred Scott, a major factor that precipitated the Civil War, which the man might have approved against women. Slave owners and their political and judicial cronies insisted the court reject Scott's claim of citizenship because he was a slave, less than human. Abolitionists attempted to convince the court that all persons were human beings entitled to freedom and citizenship. Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney declared that the original intent of the Constitution favored only the freedom and citizenship of white men. Chief Justice Taney said that the general consensus among the founding fathers and long afterward was that Negroes were, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights that a white man was bound to respect. The net effect of the Dred Scott decision was to make the issue of slavery too explosively toxic for political or judicial settlement. It was later termed a monumental indiscretion and a public calamity. Justice Felix Frankfurter once remarked that Supreme Court justices never mentioned Dred Scott after the Civil War. Any more, he said, than a family whose son had been hanged mentioned ropes or scaffolds. That particular Supreme Court decision on abortion in 1992 that was likened to Dred Scott followed the same unfortunate premise that women are not free and equal citizens and do not have the right to make elemental choices about abortion. Three decades later, in this brand new millennium, though at 21 it already seems very old, women's right to free choice about abortion remains in jeopardy and an object of an insidious tug of war that abjectly undermines civil and gender equality. The underlying hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of years. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be the instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum left by irresponsible men. Abortion, at least, allows a woman to dispose of an unwanted child before it is born. For some despicable reason, men who abdicate the responsibility for birth control yet believe they should control a woman's options, which has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining superiority over women. Women are not allowed to be free and equal citizens. For that matter, more than a century and a half after emancipation from slavery, our black people, who wish to be known as Afro-Americans in recognition of their long presence in this hemisphere. Humanity is crowding itself off its home planet. Abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of the earth by an overabundant species that seldom practices successful birth control. In the bad old days, children were abandoned or slaughtered when a population overran its resources. Abortion is a much preferable option than an AIDS epidemic and stabilizing population growth. Yet, as with slavery, abortion causes furious arguments and is such an emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is always broiling subsurfacely and eternally on the brink of volcanic eruption between advocates and anti-abortion zealots. Nothing has been settled by Supreme Court adjudications, which generally enrage both so-called pro-life and pro-choice. The court erroneously makes political decisions rather than impartial constitutional judgments that ultimately satisfy no one and are only temporarily decreed until the next judicial challenge. Like the three-fifths compromise that allowed only that much but no more consideration of human worth to slaves, the Supreme Court has essentially declared that women are, in the words of Taney, so far inferior that they have no rights a man is bound to respect. And that was something I wrote, sort of a prelude to something written by the great Ruth Marcus for the Washington Post. Leaving abortion to the states makes them agents of oppression. Writing about the future of abortion rights inevitably entails discussing precedent and the importance of sticking with it. That's the easy part. The harder questions are these. Does the Constitution protect a right to abortion? Or is abortion a matter of public policy best left in the hands of individual states? Conservatives find the first question about whether the Constitution protects abortion rights laughable. Of course it doesn't, they say. Justice Clarence Thomas put it bluntly in a dissent last year when the court narrowly struck down a Louisiana abortion law. The idea that the framers of the 14th Amendment understood the Due Process Clause to protect a right to abortion is farcical, Thomas wrote. It would no doubt shock the public at that time to learn that one of the new constitutional amendments contained hidden within the interstices of its text a right to abortion. The fact that it took this court over a century to find that right all but proves that it was more than hidden. It simply was not and is not there. And that was Clarence Thomas. I couldn't disagree with this more, but it is not by any means a crazy point of view. If you believe that the Constitution should be strictly construed based solely on the language of the text, the history leading up to it, and the understanding of the framers, abortion is a constitutional no-brainer. It's not up to judges to say, and the court had no business constitutionalizing the issue in Roe versus Wade. Still, that cramped vision of the judicial role isn't the only way of interpreting the intentionally capacious phrases of the Constitution. As Justice Felix Frankfurter, a noted advocate of judicial restraint, explained in 1949, the framers understood when to be specific and when to be vague. Great concepts like commerce among the several states, due process of law, liberty, property, were purposely left to gather meaning from experience, Frankfurter wrote. Justice John Harlan, no raving liberal, put it well in his famous dissent in 1961's Poe versus Ullman. The full scope of the liberty guaranteed by the Due Process Clause cannot be found in or limited by the precise terms of the specific guarantees elsewhere provided in the Constitution, he wrote in another passage quoted 12 years later in Roe. No one reads the Constitution and concludes, this document obviously protects a woman's right to choose. Yet the court has long interpreted the Due Process Clause to protect substantive rights, not just mandate procedural fairness. The building blocks for Roe were placed with the court's protections for the right to privacy established in Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, when the court struck down a state law that barred married couples from obtaining contraception, a protection extended to unmarried couples in 1972. The right to abortion flows logically, if not illogically, from this understanding that women have the right to control their own bodies. If the choice about whether to beget or bear a child is not up to the woman, could the government compel women to abort fetuses with genetic deformities? Could parents force their minor daughters to terminate pregnancies? As the court has said, the government has an interest in protecting fetal life, just not one that can supplant a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy before the fetus is viable. You may believe that the fetus is a person from the moment of conception. That is a sincere, laudable conviction, but it is not yours to impose on me if my moral judgment differs. The Constitution protects federalism and the autonomy of states, sure. But at its heart, the Constitution elevates the freedom, the liberty of individuals, not majorities. As with the constitutional question, the leave it to the states and the democratic process question has two sides, but ultimately fails. Perhaps there was a time when citizens reasoning together could have come up to some reasonable compromise on abortion rights. Most Americans, after all, believe that abortion should be available in certain circumstances and in the early stages of pregnancy. But we are now past the point of accommodation. There is simply no give on the side of those who believe that life begins at conception and that abortion, therefore, is tantamount to murder. If there were a moment before Roe that the country could have come together state by state to hash out reasonable abortion restrictions, it has long passed. The issue is too divisive, the anti-abortion forces too activated to settle for half measures if total victory is achievable. 10 states already have trigger laws on the books that would ban abortion if Roe were overturned. Another 9 still have their pre-Roe abortion plans in place and ready to be enforced. This does not portend a Europe-like landscape where abortion is for the most part readily available, at least in the earlier stages of pregnancy. Already in the United States, an obstacle course of mandatory waiting periods and counseling sessions, onerous licensing requirements, and other restrictions have made the procedure difficult, if not practically impossible, for women to access in many states. Returning the decision to the states would usher in an even more dangerous patchwork of some states that allow abortion, some that severely restrict it, others that impose outright or close to total bans. And this patchwork would operate to the particular detriment of poor women. Those with means will always be able to obtain abortions. The decision whether to terminate a pregnancy should not be a matter for majority rule. This is the most intimate of personal choices. Leaving abortion regulation entirely up to states would not make them laboratories of democracy. It would empower them to be agents of oppression. And that was by Ruth Marcus. Leaving abortion to the states makes them agents of oppression. And she wrote that for the Washington Post. And now, a perennial for this program, which I originally wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle, The Virgins of Spring, with a quote from Maurice Chevalier, "Thank Heaven for Little Girls," a song he sang. Spring, time for the ritual festivals of fertility, the interminable spectacles of middle-aged men of various fraternal orders, fawning over the seasoned, virginal young princesses, while obliterating any resemblance to the age-old carnality of these annual rites of fecundity. Humanity's biological clock does not keep the same tempo as its intellectual designs. We are still pagan savages underneath our surface dust of civilized society. Our ancient fertility rituals are layered in antiseptic disguises that reflect a rigidly puritanical and sexually repressed culture, despite MTV and the movies. Our libertine male ancestors, elders of various tribes or clans, demanded first crack at every spring's virgins, and later within reach of our own era, noblesse oblige, gave a local baron the right to consummate a marriage with the virgin bride of a peasant. Old bulls in the natural world fight young stags for amatory dominance over a plurality of females. Old bulls in the contrived human world compete with hair implants and sporty automobiles. Older men have always wanted to mate with young girls, not from nostalgia for lost youth, but to consolidate aging and vitiated genes with strong, robust genes, maintaining a vigorous heredity by minimizing the disadvantages of worn-out RNA. Although the desire for young lambs is socially degenerate, it reflects age-old lusts and determination to survive through greater genetic diaspora. However, for the same reason older men strive to preserve their reproductive vitality and biological imperative, few younger women are willing to risk impairing their own genetic possibilities with old dogs past their prime. After all, randy young men are strong and eminently virile and potent bulls yet, and offer the best opportunity for sturdy stock. As a woman wrote once, sperm is cheap, eggs are expensive. The sexual desire of older men and women for girls and boys is an insensate desire, a primeval siren's call to invigorate reproductivity. However, like individual body cells, each person's purposes and depravities are their own. Children throughout history have been initiated early to sex, more often as not by adults. Only recently has society prolonged sexual abstinence, just as it has prolonged childhood itself. Laws and social restrictions are designed to prevent promiscuous older persons from debauching children, especially to keep predatory males off the bodies of young girls until they grow old enough to make their own choices of mates. Older men and women, in consequence, stifle their sexual desires for the young in fear of social disapproval and legal vengeance, and sublimate them in other ways. But those who do not are very often explosive with their thwarted desires and become deviant and violent in pursuit of them. The manner in which child abuse is treated drives predators underground and into more violent acts. The strictures that attempt to protect children are quite likely perpetrators of the grotesque molestation and sexual murders of children. Pornography, promiscuity, and pedophilia are results of sexual repression and are, in turn, demanded to be suppressed. A civilization out of control breeds violence and insecurity, which is taken out on children by neurotic, bitter adults. Movies, documentaries, groups of parents, and others throughout the country advocate for laws for greater protection of children, yet abuse flourishes underground. There is, as an article in Time magazine alluded to a few years ago, a preoccupation with child abuse. In an age when lurid lyrics, sniggering sitcoms, and trash-talking stars work hard to rob children of innocence, the sexually abusive parent, guardian, or family friend is not only a predator in his own right, but also a stand-in for all the gaudy malevolence of pop culture. The public reacts with wide eyes and a bit of drool at the corner of the mouth. the public gets to be puritanical and voyeuristic at the same time, the Time article said. The attitude is basically, this food is terrible, and there's not enough of it. For thousands of years, it was acceptable for adults to have sexual relations with children, with a few exceptions, such as Native American cultures, which regarded child sexual abuse as a capital crime. Children have since antiquity been raised for sex, as slaves for purposes of prepubescent prostitution, or more insidiously, for personal sexuality, such as incest. Only recently has intensifying concern and a collective sense of shame about child sexual seduction initiated a campaign to prevent and punish it, and in particular to warn and protect children. The law attempts to protect children essentially because they don't have the intellectual maturity to differentiate between what feels good and what is good. These laws are specific. It is against the law for any adult to engage in any form of sexual activity with a child under any circumstances. Even if the child initially tried to attract the adult or assented to sex with an adult. One woman expressed eloquently the public's inflamed anger at the surge of child molestation. If anyone messed with my daughters, she said, I would nail his penis to a stump in the middle of the woods, set the stump afire, hand him a rusty axe, and walk away. Child molesters do not sexually abuse children because they are depraved, but because of opportunity. Prison does not change pederasts' attraction for children, and eventually they get out of jail. In a number of states, child molesters who have served their sentences are being kept behind bars, which is unconstitutional, and which many believe addresses a flaw in the legal system through the back door. Convicted child abusers are also targeted with emblems that identify them as molesters once released from prison in the manner early American colonial Puritans publicly marked sexual deviants. Yet the problem remains. What should be done with pedophiles who will commit such acts again and again? Given the choice of pardoning a child molester, the public would most likely set the serial murderer Barabbas free. Following a long period of neglect, public antipathy toward child abuse, whether sexual or violent or both, has swung to the extreme, making almost any adult contact with children suspect, which only severs connections between generations that are perhaps the most necessary links for human continuity other than reproduction. Hitler's policy of turning children against their parents was never as successful alienating generations as the potential suspicion between young and old is apt to be in regard to pederasty. So we sanitize our public sexual ceremonies in the same manner we act unconscious of the implications of dressing little girls to resemble women and dress older women as prepubescents. Catalogs for children's apparel display girls seductively modeling sexy dresses, midriff revealing blouses and shirts and tight pants, as well as nightwear. We are, however, a contradictory species. At the same instant we arouse the ancient lust for young girls and or boys, we act aggressively against child molestation. We ruthlessly strip the ancient fertility festivals of overt carnality, while older men pantomime with much flair and flim-flam the covert seduction of ceremonial queens selected from among virgin princesses to rule imaginary courts of spring, Scandinavia, roses, or regatta. Only fools and hypocrites deny the attractions of the beautiful. Young women and men are among the grandest creatures on earth. We all love youth, reproductively, restrictively, and retrospectively. The distinctions between abuse of our young and caresses that reflect love and respect are necessary for all of us to know. Dreams and attractions are out of our control. Our responses to them are not. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. Although it might seem that the pandemic is dying away and at its last stages, don't forget that the ends of most wars are the bloodiest periods. New corona cases in the USA top 15,000, with deaths at nearly 400. Fortunately, almost half the country is vaccinated, but why not everybody by now? So don't let down your vigilance. Advent of the silly season is no excuse for willful, careless frivolity. Remember, protecting yourself protects your friends and neighbors and everyone else who breathes the same air. I close with Voltaire. Those who can be made to believe absurdities can be made to commit atrocities.